Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com if you're online. This week, Dialect's Imogen Sawatka talks to Jack Hazeldine from Bristol People's Assembly about the surge in political engagement after the recent general election from young people. Also, could a tower block fire happen here in Bristol? Tom Cook was instrumental in stopping TMOs here in Bristol. That's the type of management at Grenfell Tower happening here in Bristol in 2009. And he's joined by Paul Smith, who's Cabinet Member for Homes on Bristol City Council. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. If you want to join in, I'll give details at the end of the show.
I am here with Jack Hazeldine, who is currently an organiser for the Bristol's People Assembly here in Bristol, to do something of a post-election analysis. The People's Assembly is a grassroots activist organisation that positions itself against austerity. It was launched in 2013 here in the UK, and Jack has worked with the organisation for over 3 years, but I can let him tell you more about that himself. So, Jack, can you tell me something about the role of the People's Assembly here in Bristol? What is it, and as an organisation, what does it aim to achieve?
Thanks, Imogen. People's Assembly, like you say, set up around 4 years ago, and then there was a large meeting in Bristol. Well, there was a big conference in London, 4,000 people. We had a large launch meeting in Bristol, had Owen Jones and Mark Steele at it, and other local people, and we had a big crowd at the Malcolm X Centre. And since then, we've had lots of rallies, lots of community meetings, lots of demonstrations and marches, and some of them have been huge, some of them have been thousands, some of them have been smaller but really vibrant. And the essence of the campaign has been trying to build a broad movement against austerity that brings in everyone from trades unions to the Green Party, left the Labour Party, but actually, really, in terms of a lot of our activists, people without, not in any party, called non-aligned people. Yeah. And also we're working with all the kind of the other local campaigns around related issues, whether that be like the NHS or housing campaigns or, local issues around the cuts locally and so on. There's always those kind of campaigns popping up, and we've supported them consistently. So that's it, really. We have regular organising meetings. Anyone who wants to join in this broad movement can join in, really. Yeah.
And moving on to the election, with 4 out of 4 Labour MPs being voted in across Bristol, do you think it's fair to go as far as to say that Bristol is at the forefront of a new movement that is fighting for change?
I think it's very fair to say that Bristol's definitely saw some of the cutting edge of this election in terms of we managed to get out a Tory MP who seemed fairly entrenched in Bristol Northwest, Charlotte Leslie, who had some of the more unpleasant aspects of the Conservative administration hanging around her, such as her dealings with Saudi arms buyers, which she'd been compensated for. It emerged in the news recently. But actually, it was more that, as you say, we had 3 Labour MPs here, which is worth saying, none of them supported Jeremy Corbyn, they actively opposed him, in fact. But, I think people very much, there wasn't time to get new candidates for that. So people very much wanted to make sure Labour held on to those seats. But we're aiming to maybe get the Tories out in Bristol North West, and there's other seats around. I can speak about those later. There's a couple in the area. But, it was one of the aims. But not a lot of people actually expected to get the Tories out in Bristol North West.
So I was going to say, were you surprised when you saw that result come in?
I guess I thought it would be closer than it was. The 5,000 majority for Darren Jones was surprising, yes. I think it goes to show... What it goes to show is the turnaround in this election was the huge mobilisation of the youth vote and working class vote. And there's a lot of working class people and communities in Bristol Northwest. People usually identify it with the more well-to-do in the Clifton and very rich parts of it. But actually, when the working class people and the young people came out to vote, we were able to beat the Tories there because of the numbers. And that was down to... big mobilisation on the ground from Labour and Momentum activists. But I think also to do with you know, we had a big NHS march starting in Horfield Common in Bristol North West, organised by Bristol People's Assembly, and a Labour candidate was speaking at the start of that and on the front of the march, and it got a lot of local press, and there was also a Labour rally a week or two later where he spoke.
So on that note, what role would you say that activist groups such as the People's Assembly and Momentum have in driving this movement forward, both in Bristol and across the UK?
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, looking at the election campaign and history of the last few years, I think the People's Assembly has been the most successful organisation in building, you know, mass mobilisations, a big demonstration in June 2015 that ultimately kind of, I think, led to, was one of the factors in the success of the Jeremy Corbyn campaign, because he'd really been one of the, you know, important figures in the People's Assembly as, you know, one of the Labour left MPs who was willing to support it, because not that many were at times. And he launched his campaign on that demonstration, 20th of June 2015. And then, you know, it was, you know, that swell of activity against austerity that summer, the reaction to the Conservatives winning the election, the rejection of the Labour austerity light agenda, you know, it was all a big part of that. And since then, you know, you obviously saw Corbyn kind of, you know, take on some of these big rallies himself. I kind of wish he'd done more of it, actually. But, you know, I guess the People's Assembly's always done those kind of things and support, you know, basically supported Jeremy in his internal campaigns. We don't support Labour, but obviously wanted to get an anti-austerity leader of the Labour Party. And we continued our activity, you know, supporting the junior doctor strikes hugely, and getting people on the picket lines, and various other campaigns that have been going on around education and things. But then, you know, in this election, you know, what you saw, like I say, there was a demonstration for the NHS. There was also a very big demonstration for education called by the NUT, and we, Bristol People's Assembly, supported that. 5,000 or 6,000 people on the streets, fantastic.
Yeah.
Demo, parents, students, teachers. Yeah. But then, you know, what you saw from Momentum and Labour activists, and I think Momentum was a driving force in it locally, was a lot of canvassing and door knocking, but also, you know, mobilising their activists through phone canvassing and also, you know, having some good meetings, and generally a sense of collectivity that is often missing from some of the Labour campaigns. Let's face it, people don't quite, you know, they know that they want to... they don't like the Conservatives, and they want a Labour government. They want something that's kind of vaguely heading in a progressive direction. But they don't usually have that sense of a collective, you know, what's the pride about things. And the pride in that manifesto, really, that, you know, that manifesto, people were really willing to go out, knock on doors, have serious discussions, even arguments with people.
And would you say, being so close to all the action, that you feel as though there is something new that's brewing, the idea of the collectives, does that feel like there's a momentum there now that wasn't necessarily there before?
No, I absolutely do. You know, I mentioned the manifesto, but I think what you've seen in Bristol, I can't speak for all the rest of the country, but it was the images I was seeing of Labour activists on the streets, and also some of the education marches, and also the big rallies with Jeremy Corbyn. You know, the feeling in Bristol and the images I've seen, it is a new sense of actual class solidarity, really, of a re-emergence of British working class as a serious political force, you know, and it was obviously a key part in this election. You know, I don't see that going away unless, you know, certain things go to pot, really, which is that I think absolutely campaigning has to continue.
Yeah.
And I think really Corbyn's leadership in the Labour Party, he needs to not give too many concessions, really, to the right of the Labour Party that was trying to undermine him before. Because actually his strength has been that radical break from Blairism and from what the Conservatives are doing. He just can continue with that amplify it, really.
Okay. It is commonly said that young people have voted in unprecedented numbers during this election. Why do you think that is? Do you think, for instance, any policies in particular have encouraged young people to get down to the polling booths in such numbers?
Well, you know, I think young people, I don't think we should kind of, what's the phrase, pigeonhole people just according to their age brackets. Mm-hmm. I actually don't think it's the defining division or characteristic in society. I think classes, and actually a lot of young people, no matter how they might consider themselves born, are being turned more and more to just you know, they are working class effectively. Even if they've gone to university, they're coming out and they're finding, you know, that it'd be very hard for them to get into high-end professional jobs. A lot of them are ending up in precarious work and so on. And then the people who don't go to university, struggling to get apprenticeships or working in, you know, being really exploited in low-paid apprenticeships and low-paid work. So, you know, I think there's a strong class dimension to the young people's vote there, and that they are having it some of the hardest. It's not just them. There's some very poor older people, people of all generations who've been hit, and families that have been hit by the Tories' austerity. But young people certainly have been bearing a lot of the brunt. Corbyn promised to scrap tuition fees. You know, he promised to invest massively in the economy and infrastructure to create, you know, thousands of really, you know, proper jobs, good, well-paid jobs. And a £10, you know, minimum wage, a living wage, you know, lots of his other policies is clearly, he's clearly pro-environment. And, you know, I think the anti-war policies as well, a lot of young people have grown up in the shadow of the war on terror. They're aware that it doesn't work. So I think there's, I don't think it's kind of a particular, you know, obviously like grime for Corbyn and like, you know, the dynamism of the social media and all those things that help. But fundamentally, you don't get that kind of enthusiasm without a solid politics that is actually tapping into people's real material interests collectively, you know, where they see themselves going. Do they feel they're going to be better off under this government candidate?
To go back to the People's Assembly briefly, which is supported by both Labour Party and Green Party members, do you think that this makeup could cause any tensions going into the future?
Well, look, you know, it's been a very interesting election, hasn't it? Because as well as it being a failure for the Tories, although they gained a greater share of the vote, they didn't, you know, they didn't defeat Labour to anything like the extent they thought they would do. But, you know, also, it's been an election where things are polarised, you know. So, you know, some of the UKIP votes have gone to the Tories, but not to the extent that people expected. You know, some of the UKIP votes have gone to Labour. And that's obviously a very, very good thing. You know, the demise of UKIP is a very good thing that we should all be pleased that there is no longer this kind of aspiring far-right party, you know, riling up racism openly in the way it has done. There's racism in the Tory party and government, but it's not the same as that kind of force on the far right. But then you've got the, you know, the Green Party's obviously lost a lot of votes to Labour. And it appears in some places the Lib Dems have lost quite a lot of votes to Labour. Look, I've absolutely no tears over, you know, the Lib Dems losing votes in England. They've gained some in Scotland. Because, you know, I feel they fundamentally betrayed young people and they betrayed progressive people all around when they went into government with the Tory party, which is something they didn't have to do, despite what they might say. I think it would have been better to have a minority Tory government that we could have mobilised against, you know, the situation we're facing now. So I've got no tears for the Lib Dems. I don't believe them when they say they're on the side of progressive people. I don't believe that at all. But in terms of the Green Party, look, you know, I think they campaigned on a fairly left-wing platform, but I don't think they put the social issues at the forefront in the way that Jeremy Corbyn and Labour did. I think they concentrated locally in their campaigns a lot on the environment, and that's well and good, but, you know, climate justice and things like that don't come without social justice. You know, they don't come without a serious challenge to the economic status quo. And whilst I think a lot of them might believe in that, I don't think they've been convincing about that in addressing it. And I'm going to continue to work with people from the Green Party. I mean, expressing my personal views here, incidentally, not those of Bristol People's Assembly. But I'm going to continue to work with people in the Green Party on whatever level. But you know, in terms of the People's Assembly, you know, whatever level they want to be involved, really. But there's no doubt that people are much more drawn to the Labour Party at the moment. And that creates a different dynamic,
because
previously the Greens and Labour has been more of a balance in terms of support in Bristol. And now, you know, the Green, maybe, the, you know, it's kind of, you know, we're just going to have, you know, you get always in these coalitions, you have to be careful to what extent, you know, you have a party, you know, dominating proceedings or something like that. And that's not what it's about, really. It's about people organising independently from political parties, because actually organising independently in movements means people can do things for themselves without it just being all about winning elections. It can be about the issues that matter and that huge pressure you can put on from the outside, on the streets and in campaigns, which political parties can't do, is extremely important. It can be important in elections, actually, but it's just important in advancing a progressive case and in winning real victories for ordinary people. So I look forward to working with all progressive, you know, comrades who, whichever way they voted, Labour or Green, in the last election.
Interesting. So to round up, we've spent a lot of this interview talking about how well the Labour Party have done, but at the end of the day, we still have a Conservative government.
Mm.
What do you make of the pledge that Theresa May has made today to end austerity?
I think it's nonsense, isn't it? I mean, when the Conservative Party ends austerity, we'll see, you know, a £10 minimum wage. We'll see a reversal of the cuts to schools education. We'll see a reversal of NHS privatisation and a pay freeze on NHS and public sector workers. You know, we'll see an end to cuts in welfare and all of these things. It doesn't just mean they're going to ease off on the rhetoric, or, you know, they're not going to cut things by quite as much. That's not ending austerity.
Yeah.
We need a restoration of the welfare state, and we need, salaries that are actually, wages that are actually keeping up with this new 3% rate of inflation.
Would you accuse her of lying then?
Well, she is a liar, as that song, song said during the election campaign, but I think it's really a matter of, that's not the most important thing in a way. It's kind of, it's the fact that I don't think anyone believes her anymore. So it's kind of,
empty words.
Yeah, it's empty words, absolutely. And, you know, look, the situation we're in is Conservatives are massively in crisis here. They didn't get anything like what they wanted out of the election. They're going to coalition with a party that nobody supports in mainland Britain. A lot of people see it extremely reactionary. And if they try and form a proper government off of this, they're going to be faced with a lot of opposition in Parliament. And to be honest, they're going to be faced with a lot of opposition in the streets, because what people see now is that Labour's ahead in the polls by a number of points. A lot of people are regretting their Conservative votes. The tide is very much on Labour's side. They see a government that's a shambles. They want them out, and they want somebody who can deal competently with the Brexit situation. And they want an absolute end to austerity. They don't believe Theresa May's going to deliver that. So I think we all need to get behind that and do what we can do on whatever level, encourage anyone to get involved. It's not just about activists. It's a funny word sometimes, but it's just about people getting active. You know, that can be coming to a meeting or just, you know, joining in some leafleting, or it can be just going along to an action or a rally or something else. And these aren't strange things. It seems funny to start with when you go to one of these things sometimes. I remember the first demonstration I went to, I was amazed by what are all these people doing, racing through the street, not racing through the streets, but kind of jumping up and down or other things. But actually it's very positive, you know, and you realise that there might be some anger, but actually it's positive. People want hope in their lives, and people are sick of despair after the 7 years of austerity. So I really hope people look to the future. They look towards a Labour government, but actually they take things into their own hands as well and demand the kind of social change they've been promised, because it's not going to be an easy ride for Jeremy Corbyn in Labour. They're going to have a lot of the establishment against them, and there's going to be limits on what they feel they can do without people on the streets and without putting that pressure on.
I guess it seems appropriate then for me to finish with this final question. Do you think that Theresa May will survive? Can this government see out this 5-year term?
Do I feel Theresa May can survive 5 years? Absolutely not.
No.
You know, I think a lot of people are almost certain about that now. I mean, who knows? But, you know, I think, look, the position that she's in, the people inside her party attacking her, you know, Boris Johnson.
The coalition
Johnson,
with the
people,
DUP as well.
Other people looming, you know, as leadership challenges. But, you know, look, who it's down to is, on the one hand, it's down to the establishment who, actually, if they wanted to remove Theresa May right now, they could do. The reason they don't is they think it'd look even more chaotic. It'd create even more problems for the Conservative Party. They don't have a completely obvious contender. There's people like Boris Johnson around, but they know he looks like a clown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they're biding their time and maybe waiting for the right moment. Maybe they think they can call another leadership election. Or maybe they'll try and ride it out and hope something bad happens. That's on the one hand. And on the other hand, like I say, you've got people who can put the pressure on through demonstrations, but also, you know, through mobilising the Labour Party, but also in their workplaces, mobilising people, you know, talking to people and mobilising public opinion and maybe even strike action, you know, against the kind of falls in wages we're seeing. So I think we can bring it to an end within months. I think there can be a general election in the autumn. I think a lot of people are quite confident about that, looking at the polls. But yeah, you know, there's contradictions in the establishment in terms of their interests. There's people on different sides there, and Theresa May's camp and other camps almost at war with each other now. But there's also us who can wage a battle on the streets against them.
Yeah, seize the opportunity.
Exactly. Yeah. And, I really think we can do that. And actually, we can get a Labour majority, if not a landslide. Mm-hmm. That's not the end of it. Like I say, they're going to face a lot of problems if Labour does get in. A lot of resistance from the private companies that have taken over public services. A lot of resistance from the establishment that favours war and, you know, policies abroad that involve kind of taking over other countries' resources. They're not going to take kindly to Jeremy Corbyn's politics over that. So there's going to have to be, you know, independent movements and people really backing up those causes.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Right, well, I'm joined now by Tom Cook, who's a retired bricklayer and active in Tenants Association for the council here in Bristol, and also Paul Smith. He's Labour councillor for Central Ward, and he's also cabinet member for Homes. Now, first of all, with you, Tom, the reason I've asked you along here is because back in about 2009, you brought the whole thing of tenant management organisations to my attention. We were looking at some of the ways in which council property was being privatised, sold off. I think it was prefabs over in Sneed Park, various other places. And at the time, there was this pressure from the Lib Dems, various Lib Dems, including a guy called Mike Popham, to get council property here in Bristol transferred over to TMOs. So what with what's happened in London with Grenfell Tower being managed by a TMO very badly, quite clearly, can you tell us what a TMO is to start with?
Well, the idea, as I understand it, is that the reality is that you split up between interested bodies. I mean, Paul might have a lot more detailed understanding of it. The council or the organisation itself, the management of the organisation, and elected tenants. So that's the theory at the end of the day. I don't think that it works, and it splits up. If I talk of the practicality of Bristol, then it would split Bristol up at the time around 30-odd dwellings into no more than, I mean, Grenfell was actually 10,000 dwellings, but in Bristol it would have been less than 3,000 dwellings. I think in Birmingham, for instance, the TMO, I can't think of the...
But the idea sounds good, doesn't it? For any... Most council tenants have got some beef with the council. And for the idea that the tenants would then take over, Tom, surely that's, you know, for most people, they would think that sounds great.
It's a theory.
People power.
Yeah, it's theory. In practice, they're dominated by the organisation of the professional organisation.
Okay, so on a typical tenant management board, what proportion of them are actually tenants?
I'd say roughly it'd be a third, a third, and a third.
Right, hang on. That's not tenants managing it. That's tenants being somehow involved in managing it, but they're not managing it.
I think the correct statement is involved, and I would think that the professionals are quite dominant in that way. I think you'd have to have tenants with a lot of experience in life and confidence to be able to challenge.
Yeah, because there's all sorts of people saying, please sign this piece of paper, please do this, please fulfil this contract. Paul, were you surprised that it was a TMO that was behind this awful tragedy in London, or at least it certainly seems was involved in managing the property, which was in a pretty awful state of not prepared for a fire?
Well, it obviously wasn't prepared for a fire. It's absolutely tragic. The issue about whether there was a TMO in place refactor, I've got no idea. But one of the problems with these sorts of complicated structures where the council owns, somebody else is responsible for the management, is when you get a problem, nobody really knows who's in charge and who's responsible. So there's a danger of confusing governance and diffusing governance in a way which means everybody's sort of responsible, but nobody really is. And that would be what would worry me about that. Obviously, I'm much more concerned at the moment with the safety of the buildings and the structure of our governance within Bristol. But as Tom says, having, you know, nearly 27,000 council properties means that, you know, we have a certain level of capacity in terms of our management.
How does Bristol compare to other local authorities around the country? What, you know, as numbers and proportion of people living in council properties and in high-rise?
Well, council properties, council housing as such is becoming more and more scarce and rare in this country. A lot of local authorities have actually turned their council housing into housing associations. So if you look at the authorities around us, you've got South Gloucestershire is run by Merlin Housing, North Somerset by Alliance Homes, and Bath and North East Somerset by Curo Homes. Council housing is becoming quite a rare commodity. If we look, where are the nearest council housing departments to Bristol? They're Taunton and Swindon.
And is that because people have been balloted and they've said, yes, we want to go with this different organisation of the tenants?
That's what's happened. And obviously it's been about there's additional money available if you become a housing association. Bristol's tenants, I think Tom was one of the leading lights at the time when Bristol looked at this, decided very strongly that Bristol should maintain its role as a housing provider and keep the council housing. And I must admit, I'm glad he did that.
Tom, what are the facilities for tenants like you? I mean, is it made easy for you to get involved? I mean, obviously you're on a tenants association, but is there any reason for a tenant to actually join a tenants association? Are the council, as your ultimate landlords, making it worth your while to actually get involved in groups like that?
I think a council, Paul, does support tenants organisation. I think there's been a downsizing of tenants' involvement, which needs to be re-looked at and re-sorted. And I've put across to Paul, to the full council, before Paul was involved, and to the Housing Management Board, before Paul was involved, that we should bring back democratically elected tenants in area committees, and from those area committees elected to the Housing Management Board. I think tenant organisation, when we had the relationship between a council officer on area committees, you then add the tenants and you then add the councillors. Councillors many times, whatever the political party, said that that's the only time that they learn about housing. They can now directly look at their constituents. And within this relationship, you start, you know, the officers can't get away with it. They can't, whether they want to or they don't. The tenants know things, the councillors know it. And that relationship is a good management structure that identifies problems and looks towards answering them. We got rid of that.
Paul, I think the obvious question for council tenants and actually all sorts of tenants in Bristol is, could something like Grenfell happen here in Bristol?
Well, looking at the you know, we don't actually know what happened, although there's, I think, you know, there seems to be a consensus forming around.
I mean, spoken to a retired fire chief. Yeah. Now, these firemen, even particularly retired people, do chat to each other a lot unofficially, and it seems pretty clear that this cladding that was put on the outside of the building was not fireproofed.
Yes, and we haven't got any cladding that's anything like what they've used in Grenfell. So we don't use the same material, which was an aluminium structure with a plastic coated covering on. We don't use that. We don't have a structure whereby there's a gap between the cladding in the wall, which can act as a flue. Our cladding is attached directly to the walls. I've been spending time going around blocks of flats the last few days with the fire service and with council officers, and the fire service are very clear that nothing that we've got in Bristol concerns them. Obviously, nobody could ever give is going to give a cast iron guarantee that everything's completely impossible. But we've had in recent years 4 fires in flats. Those fires have not spread from the flats they've been in. They've been quite tragic incidents. But the structure that we've got contains the fire within the flat that it occurs within. There was one only a few weeks ago in Rowan House in Hartcliffe, which has been clad. That fire didn't spread beyond the flat where it started. So we're fairly confident, but we want to see, obviously, what the fire investigation report is, because it might be that we do have to do more. But over the last 5 years, the council spent £10 million on fire safety in blocks. Every year, the council and fire service go round the blocks and do a risk assessment of those blocks to see if there are any issues. We're going round at the moment. We're picking up some minor issues around, people propping open fire doors and the like. We're sorting, whenever we see those, some fire doors don't close quite as well as they should. We're sorting them out. We're asking tenants to let us know if there's anything that they're concerned about. But at the moment, we don't believe it's possible for what happened in London to happen in Bristol. Doesn't mean there won't be fires. There's two or three fires in our flats every year. But so far, they've been managed. There was a fire in the bins in the block next to where Tom lives on the same day as the Grenfell fire. And that was dealt with by the fire brigade and sorted within about 20 minutes.
Now, Tom, one of the things cited by people right across Ladbroke Grove, all the whole area in Kensington and Chelsea, where this took place, and amazingly, literally just days before, it was the last constituency in the general election to be announced who'd won it, and it was only Labour only won it by, I think, Paul, was it 20 votes?
20, yeah.
20 votes, a very, very knife-edge constituency, which has just kind of embraced Labour after years of being Tories. But the main thing is, people need, as tenants, to feel like their landlord is listening. And we, as tenants, a woman called Jackie Cross and I, were removed from the board recently. In fact, before the company rules had been changed to allow them to do that. But anyway, that's another issue. And I can tell you, going through the management of those, 12,000 properties, 25,000 people, sometimes stuff would be nearly going to go past and you'd say, well, hang on a minute, this is no good. You can't do this. This is going to be a disaster from a tenant's point of view. And now that from housing associations like Knightstone, there is no proper tenant presence on the board to flag those things up. I'm thinking about, for example, one of the things Knightstone were doing was changing their eviction policy to actually make it so that officers of the organisation itself, staff, could order evictions without having to refer through boards and through tenant consultation groups and this sort of thing. And I just put my hand up and said, no, you can't do this. What, you're changing the system to say that the board and the tenant involvement groups don't have to take any part in one of the most important things, evicting somebody, for example. So anyway, I just wonder what you think as a council tenant about, do you think the council's listening to you?
At this minute, no. There are organisations. There is an organisation which is being consulted now, but those tenants are individuals. They're not democratically representative. So the council has a view of involving tenants, but that view has diminished over a period of time. And I know Paul supports...
it's definitely fallen into disrepair, tenant involvement in Bristol.
But we do... I've indicated area committees that we used to have before. And then we ended up with Housing Management Board and selected by officers and to go on that. But they're not democratic.
We know how that works. Yeah. Select pliable tenants to go on the board for you.
Well,
they were going to agree with stuff.
Well, they didn't select me, man. That's why I'm not there. But I think that once you've got rid of that, again, I'm making the point I just made before, the reason for involving tenants and the reason for involving councillors is that the tenants have information that is quite quickly, and if you don't have that, you've got these things like the fire. You've got things that happen that they're just not considerate because they're not in that same position.
Now, Paul, I can remember just a few years ago, there was a tenant resource centre on Redcliffe Way. Mm-hmm. The council tenants from all over the city used to come and use as a meeting space. Mm-hmm. They could get online. Mm-hmm. They could even put up web pages and things like that mm-hmm. to advertise their own tenants associations, mm-hmm. things like that. That's gone.
Well, the rot office is still there, but it's not used. It's used every now and again for a meeting. And I'm with Tom. Everything was about neighbourhood partnerships. A few years ago, all the resource in terms of involvement was put into neighbourhood partnerships, and the area committees, the tenant area committees that Tom's talking about, were sort of basically closed down. And the tenants' associations also have not had the support to allow them really to have a strong voice. So. There is something called the Tenant Scrutiny Group, who have been looking at tenant involvement. I've agreed with them not to make any changes until they've given me their report, which I was told was going to be due the end of May. I haven't got it yet. But we have to look again at the extent to which we listen to the voice of tenants, because there are actually quite a lot of council tenants in Bristol, very active in all sorts of other things, but not in their tenant.
I mean, has this been part of government policy over the last 10 years?
No, it's
or so?
A decision taken by the council. I mean, the destruction of council housing is a direct policy of the Conservative Party. In fact, Nick Clegg said only a few days ago that the reason, you know, when he was in government with the Conservatives, the reason they didn't want more social housing was because they equated social housing with Labour voters. And what we've seen is the, you know, the progressive destruction of council housing within this country.
Well, it's almost also a gerrymandering aspect to what's been going on in Kensington and Chelsea. A lot of people there saying that they've been basically moved out because they're Labour voters. Now, on a very, very slim majority of 20, that can make a massive difference.
Well, what we have seen is that the benefit system is being structured so that it's almost impossible for people on benefits to live in certain parts of the country, central London being one. But if the benefit system doesn't change, you know, there are parts of central Bristol where unless we have council housing, we'll find that people on very low incomes and people dependent on benefits won't be able to afford to live there.
What about building new housing? What are you doing?
Well, we've got a programme of building new council housing in two ways. One is directly through the housing department, and I'm up on the site actually on Friday this week at Alderman Moor, where we're building 150 new homes. But we've got a programme basically within the financial limits we've got of about 60 homes a year that we can afford to build. We've also set up a housing company.
Hang on, because you say 60 homes a year, which is ambitious compared to what it has been, but you've got a waiting list, haven't you? Last time I looked at that, was something like 15,000 people.
Yeah, well, you've got to let me finish, because 60 homes a year isn't all that we're building. We're setting up a housing company, which will be wholly owned by the council, which can also build housing, social housing, on our land using different sources of finance to what can be used by the council housing department.
So the central government is saying council housing department isn't allowed to use certain sorts of finance.
Well, council housing departments have never been allowed to use money from what's called the general fund, the money funded by the council tax. But housing companies set up by local authorities can use borrowing within the general fund, and that's what we're doing. We're almost at the limit of how much we can borrow in the council housing department fund, but we're going to use about £200 million worth of borrowing to take forward building through the housing company, and dare I say it, also through grants to housing associations. So we got elected on a policy of 800 affordable new homes a year by 2020. That's still our policy. We haven't changed from that. Council housing at the moment will only be, you know, 60 or 70 units a year of that 800. But if the position changed in terms of council house financing, then obviously we would build more. But the situation that's happened at Grenfell might mean we have to build less, because if, for instance, a rule comes out and says we have to put sprinklers in every flat, could come out, that isn't free. So we would have to take the money from somewhere in the housing department budget.
Suddenly you've got to rejig all your
figures.
And
so we might have to take some of the money we're going to use for building new council housing, some of the money that's earmarked for other major repairs, and put it into doing sprinkler systems.
Kensington and Chelsea had £240 million weight in there, didn't they?
Well, that's another thing that we've got here in Bristol, isn't it? We've got quite a lot of reserves that have been built up over the years. Now, everyone says, well, that's only for real emergencies. Well, surely, effectively, slowly closing the council down over the next 10 years is a bit of an emergency that money can help alleviate.
Again, because that's what's called general fund money, money from council tax, it can't be used to help with the council housing side of things. You can't use it across. We are using our reserves, we are spending our reserves to cover some of the budget gaps that we've got. You know, we inherited a council that was £30 million adrift in 1 year of where it needed to be, and over 100 million a year adrift from where it has to be in 4 years' time if this government continues in power. So we've been using our reserves and our borrowing to reduce the amount of cuts that have to be made.
Well, I'm very glad we don't have TMOs in Bristol for obvious reasons, looking at what's happened at Grenfell House. But Tom, take us back to 2009 now, around that time. Where was this initiative coming from? Because I know there was even a councillor, Cheryl Ann, a Lib Dem councillor, I think in Horfield, who was elected on the back of she would be pushing these tenant management organisations. That was one of the platforms of her being elected as a councillor.
Yeah, it was the Lib Dem councillors that was pushing it. Four areas started up with the idea. In fact, in her area, obviously there was the death and that TMO fell apart.
I think it was her partner died.
Yeah, there was a death, yes, and that fell apart, you know. In our area, the people come together. I mean, we had an area housing committee, and that was used as a base to set up this particular TMO. There was one person who was on the area housing committee who had been on for a number of years, but in a sort of technicality, he hadn't been actually elected. And so by one vote, the area housing committee voted for a TMO with a group of people. And it was on a dice, so it was roughly 3,000 dwellings. So they went through a process. There was also the one at Barton Hill. I don't know exactly the names of them. And, of course, some money went missing and somebody got jailed in that area, right? The one in our area basically was not accepted because of not being competent to be able to set up a TMO. And the one in
Barton Hill?
Barton Hill went. Mm-hmm. Horfield didn't go. There was the Bedminster fell apart. And then there was the other by the roundabout up the top of Old Market in that area.
St Jude's area.
Yeah, probably, St Jude's area. Anyway, so they went for a vote. And, you know, and people were involved. And, of course, there's a Somalian community as well.
So this is involving every... It's not just the board that's managing the area. It's the all the tenants voting.
Yeah, in that area. Of that area, the tenants was voting a few hundred. Around 1,000. I forget now the details, 1,000. Anyway, mainly the Somali people actually voted against it. I went to a meeting and a couple of us from the, you know, working on the council and myself went to a meeting of those people. Of about 30 odd people there, and they over there was a month of voting, and I think the first week there was something like 10%. I forget the numbers now, but at the end of the day, when the voting took place, there were compared with many other areas where TMOs had been set up on the basis of 10% voting or 16% voting in the country. Right, in this area, it was near enough over 50% of people. And they voted against that TMO. So TMOs fell apart. But they were never initiated to me by tenants themselves. They were manipulated from a political directive, I think, you know.
Paul, what do you think is the future for council tenants? Because many of them are in a situation where it's more and more difficult to claim benefits. The central government, we've still got, it looks like, another 5 years, possibly, of the Conservative government.
Let's hope not.
And, it's been very, very difficult for people who are on low incomes and on no incomes, some disabled, etc.
Yeah, well, if you actually look at what's called the housing crisis by a lot of people, it's the bringing together of a number of different Conservative policies. The right to buy is probably the biggest driver of the housing crisis, but the biggest driver of homelessness within Bristol, and there's 570 families in temporary accommodation at the moment, is the changes in welfare benefits. And, you know, there is, you know, an ideological assault on people on low incomes, which basically says it's your own fault. If we take your money away, we'll starve you into sorting yourself out. And you know, that is horrendous for many people. And then there are many other people who are just living on the edge of, you know, breaking even. You know, they're probably, in terms of those in the private rented sector, they might be a month away from turning up to us as homeless. In terms of people in our own council housing, we're obviously doing everything that we can to protect people and their tenancies. And we're encouraging the housing associations to do the same. But the welfare reforms are incredibly destructive.
But you can't build enough houses, can you? Certainly, you know, you're here in one of the key positions here in Bristol. There's no way you're going to build your way out of this crisis.
We can't build completely out of it, but we can make a dent on it. What we need to do is not say there is a Conservative government, therefore we give up and go home. What we say is there's a Conservative government. We do the best we can now. We build up our capacity. And when there's a changing government, one that's committed to council housing, then we've got all the building blocks in place to really accelerate that development. But if you think in terms of Bristol at the moment, we let about, between us and the housing associations, we let about 1,500 homes a year. If we start building 800 affordable units a year, then we're getting that well over 2,000. So it's starting to make an impact. It won't solve the problem, but it will start to make an impact.
And Tom, what do you think as a council tenant? I mean, have you noticed any difference in the last year since Labour have been in charge in Bristol?
I'm sorry, I can't answer it. I don't see the... I've obviously discussed with Paul, and there's a direction of travel that he's going to take.
Well, he's had a year, hasn't he? I wonder if you felt it at all.
I feel as though that the debate's there, and I'm pushing all the time. But the biggest thing for me, I don't think there's enough. Obviously, the building of a few council houses isn't going to answer the problem. Paul's not saying that, but I don't know myself what the local authority by itself can do. Right, but it's quite clearly. We need, in the country, 2 million council houses. Now, what Bristol would approach to that, I don't know. So, for me, there ain't enough in Bristol. My biggest thing is to involve tenants, is to involve those people in debate about the problems, because it's those people that will tell you and give you information, and it's those people that will contribute better to the management.
But why will tenants get involved? Just as we've heard from you, what's happening is the council has been centralising the tenant involvement. So there's less incentive to get involved. Right. It's further to travel if you want to meet, for example. You're going to have to probably go into the city centre or some other part of town.
No, we had area committees which at one time covered roughly 3,000 dwellings. There were 45,000 council houses, if you believe it or not.
Each one was 3,000 roughly, was it?
Roughly, yeah. 3,000 dwellings. And there were 15 area committees which bit by bit diminished, and thereby diminishes the information that management can get about the problems of housing, right? At this minute, we need to bring that back. Paul's said to you that it's discussing that with a group of tenants and seeing what's coming back from them. So we do need, however it's done or however, we need that involvement, democratic involvement of tenants again. Those tenants being involved will tell you there's not enough council houses being built, and it's quite clear that there isn't. And when you look at housing as a whole, in the past, where people could buy the house in 2001, the Tories took off completely. Tax relief for buying your house. From 1931 to 2001, people could get tax relief in buying the house. It was subsidised. That has now been taken away. And I think you see a left group of people in the Labour Party are those kiddies who in the past would have, the parents and grandparents could buy a house, are not going to buy a house. You know, they're riding around on push bikes selling pizzas, and you know they're the part of the momentum and a bit of the left group in the Labour Party, that they're the ones I think that voted, you know, in that stopped the Tories from really, you know, to about 2.5 million people. So those young people there now are in a position where they haven't got jobs, you know, and they're not going to be able to buy anything anymore, and the state is going to have to become involved.
So Paul, how are people like these millennials, people growing up now, who are just feeling, well, there's no chance for me to get on the housing ladder at all?
Yeah, well, I mean, the situation is appalling, and many of those are, you know, have the prospect of living with their parents for the rest of their life, which I think we all know isn't the answer. And so that's why, you know, we need to actually increase the supply of affordable and social rented housing. We need to increase the supply of council housing. Council housing gave a large number of people a real platform. And, you know, we had at one point nearly 50,000 homes. We've now heading quite quickly towards 25,000. The amount of council housing in Bristol is almost half what it was before the right to buy came in. And we're seeing the consequences of that. And we have to, we do have to reverse that for people. And we're seeing, in the 80s, at the same time, the regulation of the private rented sector also disappeared. So the Fair Rent Acts were abolished by the Conservatives. They weren't brought back in by Labour. I think that was a mistake. So you've got a diminishing social rented sector and an unregulated private rented sector, which sort of creates a perfect storm.
Okay, I'll ask you both this. You first, Paul. Were you honestly shocked and really, really surprised to see this fire in London? I think that's, we'll finish with that question. But, how surprised, honestly, were you to see that happen?
I was absolutely, what I couldn't believe was how quickly it spread. Because, as I say, we have had fires in flats in Bristol and they've not got past the flat that they're in. They've been sorted out by then. So the shocking thing was not that there's a fire. There's fires in blocks of flats across the country every week, probably every day of the week. There are 4,000 tower blocks. What is so shocking and surprising is the way it spread and the way it engulfed people. At the moment, all of the focus is on tower blocks owned by councils. There are more tower blocks in my ward in the private sector, student tower blocks, etc. I think they need to be looked at as well. I mean, I don't think fire recognises what tenure you are.
Also, I was just hearing the other day that Marlborough College, one of the poshest boys and girls schools in the country, is clad with exactly the same stuff as was put on Grenfell Tower. So it's not just we're not just looking at tower blocks here. Anyway, Tom, how surprised were you to see that fire?
Well, yeah. I mean, we had a fire in our block of flats about 13 years ago, although it were an elongated block of flats. It was confined to that block of flats, although the smoke people, and it was roughly this time of year, smoke people out up above them. The people below got washed out. It never moved other than in that way. The people above didn't. Those people, they actually had a bird that died and the cat and the dog and everybody got out. The design of the flats means you can vacate your flat to the next door's flat as well. So that's another attitude that you can have in building, and the person below got... It was confined just in that area. So having had that knowledge, of that, and we've got bin rooms which might go up now and again because people muck about. That's all confined, the design of the flats we're in.
The bin rooms have got sprinklers now.
Now, if we put a clad in, the difference is that they've had a cavity, if I make it a bit simplest, a cavity clad in, a bit like a flue. And that's, which I didn't understand could do. It's just, as a bricklayer myself, even with you've got cavity work in a house, that's all right. But you cap off cavities, if you're doing flats, at every level, you cap them off so that there isn't a continual flow of air. So I can't believe, really, I can't see how people wouldn't know. That as a bricky myself and that you wouldn't know a cavity would allow... a flue in your house, if people might remember in the past, you have a little damper which can allow the flames to flow up very quickly or slow down. Well, as soon as you've got a flue, it's just going to throw itself out.
I was quite amazed that the company that actually did the installation of this cladding, Harley Fabrications, the same morning closed down, emptied its offices, everybody went home. Mm. And I did wonder, was there an immediate knowledge from them, that something had gone wrong here and people talking at the place that had done the cladding. So anyway, that was quite surprising. Anyway, I just thought I'd finish up with that. And maybe on a slightly lighter note, Paul, I think you've said pretty much that this kind of thing can't happen here in Bristol, have you?
I've said that this type of fire, the way it spread, could not happen in Bristol.
What do you think, Tom?
Yeah, the structure of the buildings I've looked at as a building worker, a bricky, you haven't got that cavity. If it's cladded close up, and on our block of flats now, there's some people doing flat roofing, and I've spoken to them. The fire service are going to come along. I'd be happy if the contractor put a load of flames onto this insulation, because they're telling me it would just melt and it wouldn't go up like any other. And they're happy to do a show like that. So there's an opportunity just to look. So the material that's going into our block of flats is understood. And it would seem to me that people must have understood in this area, any building worker must understand a flue, you know. And so the people who managed it, I don't know what they knew, but it seems to me that the information should quite clearly have been available for them to be able to understand that.
Okay, well, it's kind of only the start of this. We'll see. We've got a public inquiry to come, hopefully not controlled by a government minister. I noticed Jeremy Corbyn, very good letter he sent to Theresa May, saying we're very happy to have a public inquiry, but it's not going to be controlled by a government minister. It's going to be run by the judiciary, which I thought was a very sensible approach. Anyway, thank you, Tom Cook, retired bricklayer, active in the Tenants Association here in Bristol, and also Paul Smith, Labour councillor for Central and Cabinet Member for Homes. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Hey, thank you, Tony.
That's all for this week, Dialect's Bristol's first weekly podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails and download the podcast the week before we go out. That's at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Jack Hazeldean, who was interviewed by Imogen Sawatka, also to Paul Smith and Tom Cook, and also the studio engineer, Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Get hold of us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897 or email prsc.org.uk. Also via the national volunteering website do-it.org. Yes, you'll find us there. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
Bristol Community FM is a registered charity, which means we're not for profit, and we're now able to support local business by offering low-cost promotional announcements and adverts about your business or products. You can even sponsor a show, event, or outside broadcast. So why not support the station that supports the communities of Bristol? And contact us today to find out more. BCFM 93.2 FM. Bristol is our community.
Possibility of tomorrow's world.
He sits alone, waiting for suggestions. He's so nervous, he's avoiding all the questions. His lips are dry, her heart is gently pounding. Don't you just know exactly what they're thinking?
You think I'm sexy?
How much is it?
Don't touch me.
He's acting shy, looking for an answer. Come on, honey, let's spend the night together. Now hold on a minute before we go much further. Give me a dime so I can phone my mother. They catch a cab to his high-rise apartment.
From 1979, those are the Hybrid Kids on Cherry Red Records. Do you think I'm sexy? And that's